The last time I was at one of the meetings of your group, you were called the Water Tower Landmark Trust. You met at Villa Terrace, and Mary Vashlevsky was your president. How long ago was that, Mary?
So about
10 years. So certainly the organization has evolved, as the neighborhood has evolved, but you're still very much obviously a part of the fabric of the larger East Side. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, is the fabric of this neighborhood. But first of all, in the context of the larger Milwaukee community, one of the things that you certainly notice about Milwaukee when you come here for the first time is the sidedness of this city. We have north, south, east, and west sides. And they certainly stand up pretty boldly, but they aren't all created equal. You've got the south side, which is everything south of the Menominee Valley. So it's half the land area of Milwaukee County. It's just one side. The other half is three sides. It's north, west, and east. And you will find plenty of room for discussion about where the line is between the east, between the north and the west sides. Where do you draw that border? And that's shifted variously over time. When Milwaukee was a brand new city, there was no north side. You just had east, west, and south because of the way the rivers lined up. So as Milwaukee kind of moved to the west and north, all of a sudden it developed a west side as well as a north side. And I put the line probably somewhere around the 30th Street Industrial Corridor, around where A.O. Smith is and on down to Miller and Harley-Davidson. But that is arguable, and you will find lots of disagreement about where that line is drawn. The east side's lines are really easy. It's the Milwaukee River, and it's the area from Edgewood Avenue, the Shorewood border, on down to the south end of the Third Ward. But what's interesting is that in a city of 100 square miles, the east side comprises exactly 4 of those square miles. So 4% of Milwaukee's land area is on what you call the east side. But within that 4 square miles, you've got a variety of very different worlds. You've got a fabric for the city as a whole, and you've got a fabric here on the east side. And the three main threads stand out pretty boldly. You've got the river thread, you've got the lake thread, and you've got one in between that kind of takes the character of both. And I want to concentrate on the lake thread because that's where we are tonight, and that is what your organization is all about. But put those in context of the east side as a whole. I guess you'd think of those threads as sort of the warp of the fabric and the woof of the fabric. Is all these cross streets, you know, from Brady to North to Kenwood to Edgewood. And you know the variety of worlds there are, you know, within that very small section of town. And you don't have to look any farther than Newberry Boulevard, you know, just out the door here. And you're basically going from a very working class settlement along the river to a much wealthier settlement along the lake. And the gradient of Newberry Boulevard is just fascinating. It's almost like watching a mountain range. You know, you go from around Oakland at Riverside Park. The homes tend to be on smaller lots and their frame as you kind of rise the hill on Newberry. The lots get larger, and you have, by the time you're at Lake Drive, it's all masonry. It's all stone and brick. You know, so you've got this shift, and that comes through very clearly when you're on a tour of the east side, kind of looking at some of the patterns. In this section of town, it's even more extreme on Kenwood, where I think it's about double the houses per block at Lake than it is over at Oakland, but it's somewhat obscured by the fact that UWM, you know, just sort of dominates that whole section on the north side of Kenwood. So you've got a really interesting fabric here on this section of the east side. To talk a little bit about the river thread in context before I begin to talk about the riverside, everything begins downtown. That's true in any city, I think almost anywhere, and it's pretty obvious when you look at the history of Milwaukee's Greater East Side. You begin in the area of Water Street and Wisconsin Avenue, which is where Solomon Juneau and his wife Josette put their trading post back in 1825, and that's ground zero for the development of Milwaukee's East Side. But early on, you've got Milwaukeeans dividing themselves according to ethnic groups, which is nothing unusual for those of you who know the city. The Third Ward was the Irish neighborhood, and you have the Germans in an area they call Germantown or the Slough, which was right around the Milwaukee Rep today. know, before that was filled in, that was largely a German neighborhood. And as time went on, they kind of moved up the riverside of the east side, and they found another ethnic group there who were the Poles, who were already on Brady Street. And they were kind of an outlying settlement that did not come kind of in that sort of expectable progression from downtown out to the outlying areas. They'd been there from the 1860s. And the reason that they were there was that Byron Kilbourne had put a dam across the North Avenue, across the river at North Avenue back in 1843. And it was supposed to provide power for a canal that was stillborn. But when the plug was pulled on that plan, it became a mill race along the east bank, or rather the west bank of the Milwaukee River, that became the source of water power for Milwaukee's first industrial district. So the area from North Avenue south to about Walnut Street, or now Pleasant, was lined with everything from flour mills to breweries to tanneries. And if you had sent a letter to someone and put the water power as the address back in the 1850s, it would have gotten there. And that was what it was known as. And because you have jobs along the water power, you have industrial jobs. And the Poles settled in what was then kind of the upper east side, Brady Street, because there were jobs close by, the walk to work, and jobs in those riverfront industries. So that was the early pattern. You think of the typical understanding of Milwaukee is that the south side's all Polish, and the Poles are all on the south side. The first Polish church in Milwaukee is St. Stan's on 5th and Mitchell. The second is St. Hedwig's on Humboldt and Brady, back in 1871. So that settlement certainly has a great deal of age. So you have, the Poles are already there, and the old water power, by the way, is now Commerce Street, thoroughfare that runs along the old beer line, they called it condominiums, along the west bank of the river. And you have the Germans and the Irish moving up from the heart of downtown, so you have them taking their churches with them. So they found Holy Rosary on Oakland, the Irish, back in 1885. And that was an offshoot of St. John's Cathedral, which was the Irish church back in those early years. And it was so Irish that the Germans who worshipped there built their own old St. Mary's because they wanted some distance from the troublesome Irish, you know, there at St. John's. The Germans move up in 1889 to the building that's still there. What is that, Kramer? This building, what's Peter and Paul in? It's Kramer, yeah, just behind the library. And that was the German center of settlement. A little later, 1939, the Italians build St. Rita's on Pleasant Street, you know, at Van Buren. So they're also that same progression. The Irish Third Ward becomes the Italian Third Ward, and just as the Irish moved up and founded the Holy Rosary, the Italians, Sicilians, move up and found St. Rita's. I think a lot of you probably know Tim Kitsky, you know, the pastor of what's now Three Holy Women, you know, which is the combination of St. Rita's, Holy Rosary, and Hedwig's. And line I can't resist repeating, he said that one day they will take in Saints Peter and Paul and call the pair Three Holy Women and Two Great Guys. So look for that in your next issue of the Herald Citizen. So that's the pattern of the river thread of the east side. The lake thread has kind of the same dynamic, but very different details. And first of all, just as the Poles kind of predated the movement outward from the heart of downtown, there were institutions here that predated urban settlement. And you could have been in Bayview, my neighborhood, and looked across the bay back in 1873 and seen the first one, and that was? Oh, the water tower. Back 1873 is when it was built. And it began back in 1871. And it became a project of a man named Edward Phelps Alice, the founder of Alice Chalmers. And he bid in the water system back in 1871, never having made a single pump or a foot of pipe. You could hire the talent to do that. You could buy the machines to do that. The important thing was to get the order. So he got the order and succeeded in creating a system that exceeded Milwaukee's expectations. And the flow was from the one that is there now is by no means the original. You had this Victorian pumping station on a pad on made land long before Lincoln Memorial Drive. And that was the pump. It was unfiltered lake water. They didn't add chlorine until 1919. So this was just water fresh out of the lake. And that was pumped up the hill and underneath that water tower, in which is nothing but a standpipe that was designed to relieve the pulsations from the pumps, a way to equalize pressure on the mains. And that kept on going across the Milwaukee River to the reservoir in what's now Kilburn Park. And that was not so much storage as it was water pressure. You have a high point, and just the force of gravity would act as pressure to move that water out into the mains to serve Milwaukee's businesses and homes and industries. So that was the pattern. And even though that standpipe was pure function in what I've described as an uncharacteristic fit of civic whimsy, they decided to surround that tire with a fairy tale castle, like something out of the Brothers Grimm. And they haven't needed that relief of pressure for a very long time, but the tower obviously remains. You are its namesake. It's certainly a cherished East Side landmark and a cherished Milwaukee landmark as well. And it goes back to 1873. One reason that they put the pumping station where they did and the water tower where it was because back in the 1870s, no one lived here. There were no residents to bother. There were no one's noses to get out of joint in terms of a development here along Milwaukee's lakefront. And that was a pattern that was repeated a bit later as well. There was another landmark that was also here, not quite so visible, from across the bay, and that was St. Mary's Hospital. And that goes back, not the hospital itself, but the land use in that section of your neighborhood goes back to 1846, which is the year Milwaukee received its city charter. So this is real early in the game. And back in 1846, the city bought 40 acres of land, which were just north of its limits. Back then, North Avenue was the north end of the northern corporate limits of the city of Milwaukee. And that parcel ran from Downer to Maryland and from north to Bradford. So that was the area that the city of Milwaukee decreed and declared would be used for health and social services. And among the first institutions there back in 1846 was the poorhouse. So this is where people who were completely on their heels with no other means of support and no housing, this is where they were housed, rather, in Dickensian fashion, just to avoid having them lose their lives in the streets. Same time, you have what was termed back then a pest house for infectious diseases, and you have a public school later on, homes for the Protestant and Catholic elderly. They are still there, the Protestant and Catholic homes. What they called an industrial school for girls, which was essentially a reform school for what we call delinquents today. But by far the more obvious institution there was St. Mary's Hospital. And St. Mary's was actually founded by the Sisters of Charity downtown. Again, that's the origin. That's where things begin. That's the nucleus. And it began as St. John's Infirmary on the corner of Jackson and Wells back in 1848, just 2 years after Milwaukee became a city. And it was known, among other things, as a hospital for sailors and immigrants who had been stricken with typhus or smallpox on the boat. So had these quarantines, infectious diseases, so they felt like they needed to be kind of on the edge of town as well. So they built the first installment of what's now Columbia St. Mary's back in about 1856, or 1858 rather, and it was a response to people from the city saying that what they called the seat of pestilence was not something they wanted downtown, so they pretty much asked it to move, out to the edge of town, north of North Avenue, where it is to this day, and has been ever since in one incarnation or another. It's one more landmark that predates urban settlement and the Water Tower neighborhood, and that was the North Point Lighthouse. The first lighthouse was at the east end of Wisconsin Avenue, and that site was claimed for urban development. And they built the first installment of the present lighthouse back in 1855. So this, again, goes way back to the very early years of urban settlement in the Milwaukee area. And it was forced to move from the a site a bit farther east because of erosion of the lake bluff. So they had to move it out of harm's way to its present site. And that's not the end of it. And we'll talk about that just a little bit later. All of these landmarks are certainly intimately associated with your neighborhood today, but they had nothing to do with the neighborhood, at least at first. The seeds of your neighborhood as a human community, they again go back to the heart of downtown. And just as you have the Irish working class in the Third Ward, the German working class along the east bank of the Milwaukee River, you know, near the present site of City Hall, you have a neighborhood called Yankee Hill developing around St. John's Cathedral, you know, over toward the lake. But the motion was from the river to the lake, not the opposite. You know, the lake was not desirable land. That was kind of remote from the business heart of town and subject to winds and weather. So things began at the river and moved east and north from the corner of Water Street and Wisconsin Avenue. And they called it Yankee Hill in those early years because that's where the Yankees lived. And these are people, they also called them the Yankee Yorkers, people largely of British background who were born generally in New York or New England and moved here on the very first wave before they were immigrants, you know, who were coming here. They were quickly outnumbered by those immigrants, but they remained dominant in terms of the economy and the political power in Milwaukee as well for certainly a generation. And you see the legacy of that first period in the East Side's history today just by looking at the church steeples. There are two sections of town that are distinguished by their concentration of steeples. One's down on Walker's Point, and that was ethnic. When you're going down the high-rise bridge, look off to your west around Allen Bradley or Rockwell. You'll look off to the west there, and you'll find the highest concentration of churches probably in Wisconsin. And they're Irish, they're German, they're Norwegian, they're Czech, they're Yankee. But they tended to be serving kind of a working-class population. Yankee Hill was not working in that economic stratum. These were churches built by people of British extraction, and among them were All Saints Episcopal, St. Paul's Episcopal, one block apart. And the reason there are two Episcopal churches there was All Saints is the cathedral, which means it's the chair, the place of administrative power for the Episcopal Church. And that was the high church. St. Paul's was and is the low church. And some people call it Mr. Paul's. But it's far less liturgical than All Saints. Only a block away or so from All Saints, you've got Emmanuel Presbyterian, founded back in 1837. So very early on the ground. And all these churches began right in the heart of downtown in what you consider cottages today. And by the time they moved to Yankee Hill, their members were doing just fine. They'd gotten in on the ground floor, were making fortunes, and their churches reflected. So you have brownstone from the Lake Superior region, Lewis Comfort Tiffany windows, just a high degree of finish of a lot of these churches. Among the others there, First Unitarian, Summerfield Methodist, as well as Baptist Church. And you'll notice that if you look at those churches today, no Lutherans, no Catholics, no Jews. You know, those were the immigrant faiths. It was the Anglo-American faiths that were present on Yankee Hill, and that heritage is certainly preserved and expressed in the churches that are still in Yankee Hill today. So Yankee Hill was eventually filled to capacity, and as it was, Prospect Avenue became the northerly extension. As the Blue Book, as they called it, was expanded, you had more and more families moving up Prospect Avenue. And the attraction there was the fine prospect of the lake, this wonderful view of Lake Michigan. By this time, people are appreciating the great resource, you know, that has always been the dominant resource to Milwaukee's east. And they lined Prospect Avenue from around Ogden all the way up to roughly North Avenue with one of the finest collections of Victorian mansions in the Midwest. So this was certainly a standout neighborhood, and as you know, has been rather transformed in recent generations. You know, some of the old buildings remain, but they're largely used as offices, and one still open, Charles Ellis Museum, in its original configuration and open to the public. They retained ties to their Yankee Hill churches. They commuted to downtown offices, and a lot of them socialized at the Town Club, which was on the southeast corner of Farwell and Brady. where the CVS pharmacy is today. And that's where they would play tennis in summer and ice skate in winter. So that was a real focal point of social life for the more affluent families who settled along Prospect Avenue. As Prospect, in turn, was filled to capacity, like the Yankee Hill neighborhood, that current of affluence turned right at Lafayette and developed this section of Milwaukee's east side and continued along the lake bluff, beginning in roughly the 1890s and moving up to roughly around Edgewood by 1930. So you've got like a 40-year period where most of the homes in this neighborhood were built. There are in the area south of North Avenue roughly 400 homes designed by architects for some of Milwaukee's most prominent families. Frame houses are, as you know, actually a rarity here. And the majority of them had libraries, maids' quarters, multiple fireplaces. Those were practically standard. And you have exceptional stretches like Terrace Avenue. And among them, you have one very distinguished row of four houses just south of the water tower. In the south, you've got the Herman Falk home, built back in 1902, although the first home kind of encased there goes back to the 1860s. Right next door, you have what's now Villa Terrace, which was built as the Lloyd Raymond Smith House back in 1923 by Society architect David Adler. And what he was doing was designing a faithful version of a Mediterranean villa here in the upper Midwest, to the point where on the gatepost it says in stone, Sopra Mare, which means above the sea in Italian. So it's kind of trying to do the whole nine yards. It should be Sopra Lago, you know, if you were to be appropriate. Right next door to Villa Terrace, you've got the Gus and Hilda Pabst Mansion going back to 1907. And they moved from Highland Boulevard on the west side when the east side became kind of the place to be. And right next door to Gus and Hilda was the home of William Goodrich and his wife Marie, whose maiden name was Pabst. That building goes back to 1895, and it was a wedding present from Captain Fred Pabst to his daughter and his son-in-law. So Gus and Marie could have gossiped kind of over the fence about family affairs in the Pabst family. And one that's gone just north of the Goodrich home was the Otto Falk Mansion. He was for many years, he was a brother of Herman, who founded the Falk Corporation, and was for many years the head of Alice Chalmers. And after he died, his family sold the home. It became the headquarters of the County Historical Society. You date yourself as I do, if you recall when that was the headquarters of the County Historical Society, before they moved down to that wonderful Second Ward Savings Bank on 3rd and Kilbourne. And the county tore that house down back in what, Barbara, the 60s? Maybe the 70s, at a time trying to preserve the lakefront for public use. This was before the preservation movement got traction. You know, and that building certainly would have remained very popular and certainly a prominent icon in this section of Milwaukee's Upper East Side. And on farther north on Terrace, you've got the Trostel Castle at Bellevue, and that was built in 1900. And I think a lot of you probably have copies of Shirley MacArthur's book, North Point Historic Districts, and she talks about the reminiscences of people criticizing the Trostels for moving so far out in the country. It was kind of way beyond, you know, the settled section of the east side. You also had fine homes built for Fitzgeralds, Slocums, Brumders, and Harnischwegers. A lot of the North Point homes are built in the Tudor style, and a lot of them are Alexander Chadbourne Eschweiler designs, who was a neighborhood resident as well as the most prominent architect here. But you also have Frank Lloyd Wright's Bulk House, goes back to 1916, and certainly well-maintained by the Elsners over many years here, and an icon for Wright devotees from around the entire world. North Point was, in a lot of ways, an extension. The earlier settlements to the south, especially Prospect Avenue and Yankee Hill, and those Yankee Hill ties persisted, and you see it in kind of this generational change. Yankee Hill churches gave birth to North Point churches. They were their offspring. A couple examples. The offshoot of Emmanuel was Westminster Presbyterian, and that's in the corner of Farwell and Bellevue. That was built back in 1895 as kind of the daughter of Emmanuel. It's now Epicos of a community church, you know, just as Westminster has gone out of business. St. Mark's, just off Downer, began as an offshoot of St. Paul's, built on Bellevue and Hackett back in 1904. So you have kind of these daughters of earlier congregations. In the same way, it was the daughters and sons and granddaughters and grandsons of people who might have lived on Yankee Hill who built the homes here on North Point. It's kind of a second-generation settlement in terms of the residential neighborhood as well as the churches. So you have similarities, you have connections, but you also have some very important differences between North Point and its source regions to the south and the southwest. The first is that it was ethnically mixed. A lot of Yankees were here, and you have that old connection with Yankee Hill farther south, southwest. But you also had German brewers, obviously, the Paps and the Elines, north of Kenwood on Lake Drive. You have Irish meat packers, notably Michael Cudahy. You have Czech trunk makers. The Romadka family was here. So in a lot of ways, you might say the class trumped ethnicity in this neighborhood. It made more importance in terms of what you were doing in terms of Milwaukee's economy. You also had a metropolitan Gold Coast developing here. By the teens and 20s, when this area was still very much in the throes of rapid settlement, back in those years, every neighborhood had its own kind of mix of wealthy and working class residents. As transportation improved, especially the automobile, which became the main means of transportation for wealthier families in the early 1900s, the east side became the place to be for everybody. So you have people like Henry Harnischfeger moving from 35th in Wisconsin, or Gus Pabst moving from 32nd in Highland, because the east side, North Point especially, became the place to see and be seen and to enjoy the lifestyle of living within reach of town, but within the influence of the lake as well. So the North Point residents had a lot in common, and they enjoyed some common amenities as well. The most important was this one, Lake Park. And certainly this remains an amenity that is valued by all of you and by the rest of us in the Milwaukee area as well. It was actually built as part of the city park system before there was a county park system of much scale back in 1890. And what they planned was to link it with Riverside Park along Newbury Boulevard. So you have the Chicago Boulevard system. There was a version here as well. So Riverside and Lake were to be linked by Newbury. On the south side, Mitchell Park and Forest Home Cemetery, an early version of a park by Layton Boulevard. On the west side, Sherman Park and Washington Park, linked by Sherman Boulevard. So you have that very much a part of the landscape of today, and it stands out pretty clearly on the east side in the early 21st century. As you all know, the designer of Lake Park was the firm of Frederick Law Olmsted, and some of the main changes were he filled in a ravine to create the Great Meadow, which is now the Par 3 golf course, and just on the other side of the parking lot, laid out carriage drives, and created certainly a very appealing blend of passive and active recreation. There was also a great deal of local involvement here, and the patron saint and someone I would like to have met was Christian Wall, who was a retired glue manufacturer who was raised in Milwaukee but made his money in Chicago and retired here when his career was over. He came home back in 1886 as a full-time volunteer. He was the head of the Park Commission in its first incarnation, and he was certainly an activist. You think of Lake Park as always having been leafy and green, having always been this arboreal oasis. Not the case by any means. This was just as barren of trees as the rawest Waukesha County subdivision. This had been just cleared to make way for farmland, and there were some recreational amenities back in the early years. The Ludeman family had a grove of trees on the north end of the park, Ludeman's on the lake, and the contrast was where the comparison was Ludeman's on the river, which became what is now Hubbard Park. And that was one of the very few specimens of trees or areas of trees in Lake Park. Christian Wall was someone who kind of railed against it. He talked about why they chose Lake Park, and it was one of six major purchases made back in 1890. He said the commissioners especially endeavored to select such property
as had not yet been entirely denuded of timber by the ruthless acts of speedy Western civilization. So trying to buy in advance of complete nakedness for the landscape, but there was a lot of restoration to do. He called Lake Park, the site, one of the most beautiful park sites in the world, but it had one glaring deficiency. He said, the mania for cutting down trees has impaired the value of a large part of this park property. So his goal was reforestation. And what you see in Lake Park today is, in some very important ways, the legacy of Christian Wall and his cohorts on the Park Commission. He personally supervised the greening of Lake Park, lived a bit west of here, and lived in a mansion on Prospect. He was a constant presence here. Crews working under his direction, even though he was completely volunteering and without any elective capacity or on the staff of the Park Commission. He was a volunteer chair. They planted, by his own rough estimate, thousands of forest and nursery trees and tens of thousands of shrubs. And the bigger ones, including the oaks, and elms as well, were transported from rural areas to Lake Park by sled during the winter months, so they could kind of get a foothold in the soil and then grow roots as the weather warmed, the soil warmed in spring. And after each one of those giants was planted, he raised a glass of champagne. So descendants of those trees are still here, and I fervently wish that Milwaukee had more spiritual descendants of Christian Wall as well. Use someone like him today. Wall's work created a rather unusual problem for one of North Point's earliest icons. As Lake Park's trees grew, they grew so vigorously that they blocked the light from the North Point Lighthouse. You know, the first one was, it's the area, you can see it, two stages on the lighthouse. You know, the first one is the one that's, I'm sure, one's round and one's more rectangular windows. It's like a Polish flat. You know, they kind of put the older section on top of the superstructure. So because they had to clear the trees, not only did they move it back because of erosion, but they had to raise it because of the trees. And that was finished back in 1912 and put on a 36-foot base. And ships on Lake Michigan were safe again and remained so until the light was decommissioned in 1994, by which time the city was so bright you didn't really need a lighthouse just to see that something was here if you were out on Lake Michigan. Another problem required more invention. As I said, lakefront erosion was a horrendous problem in the early years here on the east side and in Bayview as well. And there was no permanent solution until Lincoln Memorial Drive was finished back in 1929. And this was during the time when socialists, especially Charles B. Whitnell, were in charge of park development here in Milwaukee. And you might have thought that the wealthier families like the Smiths and the Falks and the Paps, whose lots went down the hill all the way to the lake, might have resisted, you know, having kind of everybody in their backyards. As it turned out, they were glad to give easements because it meant their property was protected. The landfill that became Lincoln Memorial Drive was their bulwark against these horrendous northeast storms, you know, that might have washed away many feet of their property every single year. So that's how Lincoln Memorial Drive was created, and it was finished back in 1929. The drive is still there, and it's as popular as it ever was. Lake Park is still here, and certainly is North Point's major amenity, and one for the entire community as well. I think the description of Milwaukee's lakefront parks as pearls in a necklace is apt, and I think Lake Park is the most lustrous of those pearls in the entire system. So you have settlement here, its amenities, the buildings as well, complete by roughly 1930. And there was a seam in the middle as this was going on. You've got the river thread kind of moving up to the area west of UWM by roughly 1930. The lake thread by 1930 as well, up to Edgewood, the Shorewood border. And in between, you have this area of nice homes, but smaller, smaller lots, and a lot of multifamily. And the hinge there, the border, is Downer Avenue. And that was the seam between these two, not so much threads as pieces of fabric, and making up this part of Milwaukee's east side. And Donner Avenue itself certainly became almost like Brady Street. In the early years, Brady was the commercial district for people who lived both north and south, and also the border between the Polish neighborhood to the north and kind of the Victorian, more Yankee neighborhood to the south. So it was a point of confluence and a point of commerce as well. And Downer played much the same role. The anchor of that strip was the Downer Theater, which was built back in 1915. So it's got a centennial coming up. And by 1921, which is the first year that you had in the city directories, the reverse directory where you can kind of trace who's there, address by address, you have on Downer the Milwaukee Motor School, the Downer Sweet Shop, Moody's Billiards, Alexander's Shoes, National Tea, and what's now the hot dog store, the old Licks, right in the corner. The Progressive Music School, in addition to three butcher shops, two bakeries, and two drugstores, all just between Webster and Park. So this was a densely settled commercial area. And one anchor moved in back in 1927, and that was Harry W. Schwartz Bookshop. And now Boswell's Books, and certainly anchor that remains, you know, a vital part of the Downer Avenue strip to this day. So you've got Downer Avenue serving residents on both the east and west sides of this part of Milwaukee's east side. You also have another pattern developing in the years after 1930, which is that nothing's happening. The Depression begins in roughly 1930, and it bottoms out in 1933. You can't get a mortgage, you're not going to buy a home, not build a home. So that was followed roughly 10 years duration by World War II. So for 15 years between 1930 and 1945, things were on ice in this neighborhood and in virtually every neighborhood in the entire country. And so you have just things slowed to a standstill, things becoming extraordinarily dormant. And it was in the years after World War II that you have change taking place again and beginning to accelerate. There was a period that some of you may recall back in the 1950s and 1960s when everyone thought they had to live in the suburbs, when there was a mania for the new, when things that were of any age were felt to be kind of de classe, you know, something that was part of the dead and buried past, and you didn't want them. That was this neighborhood. You know, certainly there was a market for these homes, but nothing resembling what it became after 1970. So in this neighborhood, some of the mansions went to nonprofits. Milwaukee County tore a number of them down to create parkland, both north of around the Water Tower area and in what's now Back Bay Park. St. Mary's began to buy land for expansion, hand over fist, and a lot of that expansion took place in the 1970s. And one major land use here was UWM, and they began to buy land for student housing as well as for campus institutional buildings, especially north of Kenwood Boulevard. And they, like other institutions, had their roots downtown. They began as an offshoot of Milwaukee Female Seminary, which was down near the Yankee Hill neighborhood. And in 1899, they had kind of morphed into the Milwaukee Downer College, and they built the campus that's right there on Hartford and Downer. And that was certainly a unique part of UWM campus today, and back then was kind of out in the boonies. It was kind of beyond the settled area and a prominent school for women as well. It was joined by the State Teachers College in 1909, and that is now Mitchell Hall for UWM. And those two institutions remained independent until 1956. And that's when the UW system, you know, these systems of the state teachers' colleges, you know, became four-year, in some cases two-year accredited institutions. And they bought the Milwaukee Downer campus buildings, and Downer kind of moved in with Lawrence up in Appleton. At least there was kind of a paper transaction where they transferred their assets to Lawrence and Appleton. And from the time UWM opened in 1956, it had 4,481 students in its very first year, and that has ramped up to roughly 25,000 in more recent years. So as you know better than anyone, students and faculty and their cars have had a huge influence on this neighborhood ever since, from 1956. In other ways, there has been relatively less change. The threats have passed. You have, again, these cycles that take place. Now, you have Columbia in the area of West WM merging with St. Mary's, and they build this, $350 million hospital, just on the site of original St. Mary's. It goes back to 1858. And again, concerns about the impact of these large institutions on the neighborhood around it. But those threats, by and large, have passed without denaturing the North Point neighborhood. It never had to be brought back from the dead. And I think that's something that's critically important to recognize about this neighborhood compared to others of its age and vintage here in the Milwaukee area. It was never a Walker's Point. It was never a Brewer's Hill. It was never an area that went completely out of fashion and had to rise like Lazarus, kind of from the dead to enjoy popularity in the years after 1970, which is when the preservation movement finally gets traction. People finally wake up and realize, we need to preserve these older buildings. So restoration certainly has been needed, as it is for all older buildings, but the homes have held their value and, as you know, have appreciated as well. So why the popularity? You know that you live here. This is perhaps the finest neighborhood in the city of Milwaukee. Uniformly high architectural standards, a great combination of comfort and convenience. You're only a mile or two away from the heart of a major city, but there is definitely an air of tranquility here, contributed in large part by the lake, the presence of the parks here. At the same time, this is a city neighborhood. It is an integral part of a larger whole. And you as residents and as an organization are involved in the life of the larger city, and you form a deep pool of capital, human as well as economic, that serves as a metropolitan asset. So North Point today is an architectural showcase, water tower area. It is a place to take our out-of-town guests. It is a living museum of local history. In a broader context, the water tower area is what it's been since the very beginning, and that is one of the brightest threads in the fabric of neighborhoods that together make up the city of Milwaukee. Thank you. Any questions? Amendments? Additions? Yeah.
I'm curious about the multifamily structures in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The apartment buildings, which are most of them now condos. Where did they fit into everything you just described?
More west of Downer and more teens, mm-hmm. teens and 20s, some a bit earlier. But you've got, it's again that sort of the lake middle river. Mm-hmm. And the middle pattern is sort of following what's going on around Brady Street. You have the section always being kind of a haven for singles, sometimes depending on the generation, older, sometimes younger. Back in the 60s, it was all younger. Before that, it was largely older. Mm-hmm. But a demand for multifamily housing near the heart of town. So that's kind of a World War I development in its first incarnation.
But there are some 100-year-old multifamily dwellings. And where would they have fit into? What kind of people would be living there in the early 1900s?
Early 1900s, probably the same folks who would have lived on West Wisconsin Avenue, which was the same pattern. Single households, perhaps your dowager aunt or some
people. I always knew it was dowager aunt.
This would have been one of the headquarters for dowager aunts.
Okay.
Capital for dowager aunts. But you could check some of that, not until 1921, but just a fascinating way to do research is to do the reverse directory in the city directory, the pink pages, and kind of chart who lives in every block, and then go back to the main directory, the white pages, and find what their occupations are. Okay. So you can recreate in some fairly substantive ways, who lived in all these neighborhoods by 1921. Other questions?
Yeah, you mentioned the pest house earlier. In the northeast corner of the UWM campus, there's a wooded area there. Mm-hmm. And I used to walk through there coming home from UWM. There were the signs of a foundation in there that I had heard was a smallpox isolation building.
In Downer Woods?
Right.
I'm not aware of that. Are you, John? No. There was a hospital across the street back until the 70s, but I'm not aware of that. What I've heard about the pest house was right near the site of St. Mary's, Columbia St. Mary's today, and it was back in the 1840s, they didn't treat, they just isolated. And a hospital was not a place you went to get well, it's a place you went to die. You know, if you went to a hospital, things were, a hospital, it was like a hospice, basically. And in many cases, isolation for quarantine, for infectious diseases. Any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Anything on synagogues or other religions in there?
That's a really interesting pattern. I did a book 2 years ago called, One People, Many Paths, the History of Milwaukee's Jewish Community, and it was for the Jewish Museum. And the pattern early on was you had German Jews and Eastern European Jews, and the Germans were earlier and wealthier. The Eastern Europeans, that's Golda Meir's generation, you know, were impoverished, came over with nothing. And they lived on the west side around the Haymarket area, around Hillside today. And the big congregation for the German Jews was Emmanuel, you know, which began downtown on what's now the MSOE campus. That moves up to, as you know, it's now the Zelazo Center for the Performing Arts on Kenwood, and is now in River Hills, so on Brown Deer. So you have a group of East Side Jews, largely not so much the North Point area, along Prospect Avenue, you know, the Adlers, a number of them lived there as well. Then you have B'nai Yeshurun, which was the Eastern European, or actually it was German-Jewish, but it was on the west side. There was a German-Jewish population there as well. And after World War I, just as you have the Harnischwegers and Pabst moving to the east side, a lot of B'nai Yeshurun's families had moved to the east side. They were going to build their own temple around, I think one of the plans was around North and Prospect. And they said, what are we doing? You know, we've got these families who have the same economic stratum, and why not merge with Emmanuel? So Emmanuel B'nai Yeshurun became the congregation. So that was the merger. And by that time, Emmanuel had already built its temple on Kenwood, and B'nai Yeshurun moved into it. And the old B'nai Yeshurun became, it was cleared for the county courthouse back in 1931. And that was one pretty obvious incentive for moving, because their land was basically condemned, you know, by the county. Yeah, John?
What's the background of the, I guess it was originally a Masonic temple on Hackett and 2600 block, and then mm-hmm. the Italian Community Center.
Right.
Now, where did...
Church in the City. Right. What was that called, Excelsior? It was the Masonic Lodge.
I think it was originally a Masonic
Lodge. It was, oh yeah, but they all had names. Do you know, Kathy, what that Masonic Lodge was? That's near your place. But it was there were Masonic lodges all over town. And one of the largest is what was Plymouth Congregational Church early on before they moved up here. And it was on, Jackson and Wells, basically?
Oh, yeah.
No, that began as a Masonic temple. The Triple I Shrines on 32nd and Wisconsin Avenue. The Kilburn Lodge is just around Mount Sinai Hospital. So it's just as
what was the membership?
Who was the membership?
Yeah.
Largely, not exclusively, but largely Yankee. You know, people who came from Anglo-Saxon stock. And in some ways, just like the Germans had Turner Halls, you know, the Masons, you know, would have that was their club. And it was, as you know, kind of a secret society and a variety of degrees. The Shriners were more kind of, they called that the Masonic Playground. Now it's the guys with the fezes and the go-karts. But you have, as in the same way that churches would kind of follow their members, so you have like a St. Mark or a Trinity kind of moving up following the Protestants, you have, you know, the Masons kind of bring their institution with them as well. And that the one right behind Downer was in the same pattern. You know, Jerry?
Yeah, I think it was Kenwood Lodge.
Kenwood Lodge, okay. Okay. And that was the ICC, as you said, for a long time.
Yeah.
And now Church in the City. So, yeah.
What was the mechanism and the timing for how many poor sort of mansions that were along Terrace, George Terrace, becoming a music building with a private house in the but then more specifically, I'd like to know how the Taps and Rivers mansions went out of being private homes and became now sort of
Villa Terrace became Villa Terrace because it was a gift of Mrs. Smith upon her death to the people of Milwaukee. And that was an extraordinary act of generosity. It became part of the War Memorial Complex, and now, as you know, managed as a decorative arts museum. And the date on that is roughly 1966. You know, it was in the mid-60s when that ownership took place. The other buildings, the two north, those were, and this is the pattern everywhere. It's true on the west side, it's true on the east side. You have these huge mansions, especially in the years after World War II. It's an exaggeration to say you couldn't give them away, but it's in that ballpark. You know, people, they were drafty, they were huge, they were expensive to maintain, people didn't have maids anymore. You know, so these buildings were considered kind of outmoded. So as the second generation, perhaps the third, chose not to live there, chose to move to Fox Point or Bayside, or in the case of the Pabst, Oconomowoc, you know, those homes were surplus. And they were, I couldn't say when, but it would be after World War II, probably 50s, maybe 60s, you know, by that time. And that's the same time when you have, you know, UWM's 1956, and you have those big mansions, you know, along the lake, and what, Hefter Conference Center, it was the Schlesinger home. The families didn't want those, you know, so they were either, in some cases, given, more often purchased at not extraordinarily exorbitant terms by UWM because they had some need for these sort of institutional spaces. So largely 50s and 60s is my guess is when a lot of that took place.
So,
Anyone else correct that? Robo? Farwell was a Wisconsin, what's his name, Leonard. He was a governor, Wisconsin governor. So that's where the name comes from. And it was if you look at the buildings today, there's still a lot of residential there. So it was not quite, maybe the comparison to the west side is sort of Wells was more commercial, Wisconsin was more residential. You know, so you have kind of that serving the more Gold Coast residential area. But there would have been more commerce on Farwell, certainly. And the houses, you look at the step down, you know, the surviving houses along Farwell, and you go from these stone castles, the ones that survive on Prospect, to these frame duplexes, so sharing a lot of land in some cases. So a pretty dramatic shift there. So never entirely commercial. That's certainly intensified in more recent years.